Broadcasting from a secret basement location under an abandoned marketplace, it's the Funk Zone Podcast with your host, Ted Mills.
Why, hello, 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 folks. Welcome to the Funk Zone Podcast. This is episode 83. I am your host, Ted Mills. Thank you for listening. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for coming in, sitting down, kicking off your shoes. This is the show where I interview artists and creative people, and I try to find out why they do what they do. Today on the show, we have choreographer Laura Carlin. Since 2007, she's been the artistic director of Invertigo Dance Theater in Los Angeles, which is currently touring with After It Happened, an intense night of dance set in the aftermath of a cataclysmic event. But it's got comedy in it too, so don't worry. She'll be bringing that to Santa Barbara's The New Vic on October 22nd and 23rd. That's 2016 for those of you who don't know what year it is. However, I got a chance to talk to Laura when she was up here recently on a site visit, kind of a promotional thing. And so we did. We sat down, had a chat about her art and how she got into it. And if anyone's at that stage where they want to go to that next level, start a company of their own, you may want to check this podcast out. Thanks to everybody at the New Vic and to Allison at Ravenscroft PR for making this whole thing happen in the first place. Hello, Allison. You can find Invertigo Dance online at www.invertigodance.org. It's pretty basic there, and other places around the web will also feature a few of their YouTube clips on the page for this site. Ooh, so go check that out. Now, as for me, very briefly, I just got the ball rolling on this very exciting thing we are planning for the upcoming 100th episode of the show. It's coming. 100 episodes. It is coming. Of course, I want to tell you all about it and what we're going to do, but until some details are finalized, I am just letting you know that it will be happening. I will build it. You will come, but I can't say anymore. In November, I'll tell you that. In November, so mark your calendars very roughly. Just circle the entire month and leave that open. And then I will probably tell you more later, a couple of episodes later, you'll know more about it. Also, a brief shout out to an anonymous donor who gave us a little nice cash injection last week. Thank you, person who did that. Very, very well needed. Very appreciated. Thank you very much. And thanks to everyone up to now who has throwing a little cash our way. Always nice. We will continue to make these podcasts for that very reason. Also, if you're liking the show, please consider joining our mailing list over at funkzonepodcast.com. You'll hear about new shows first. You'll hear about special deals. And every Friday, I send out this email to the mailing list subscribers with 10 links to art, videos, cool writings, and such. It's a curation. It's a curatorial email from me. You gotta sift through stuff. The internet has a gabillion things, and I just choose 10 of them for your eyeballs only. Also, in the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter at Ted Mills. Yeah, that's pretty obvious. And like us on Facebook at The Funk Zone Podcast. And subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher and Google Play and wherever fine podcasts are available. You can also show your support by pledging as little as a dollar podcast over at our page at patreon.com/funkzonepodcast. That is less a month than like a pressed juice. It was certainly less than a pressed juice. Have you seen the prices of pressed juices? Anyway, saving you that $4 for an entire month. What? What a deal. Okay, let's get this interview going with Laura Carlin. It was recorded July 7th, 2016 at the New Vic and is now warmed up for your listening pleasure. Here we go. Okay, sounds good to me. Laura Carlin, welcome to the Funk Zone Podcast. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Ted.
We are in the basement.
We're in the basement.
An undisclosed basement location below the new Vic.
Coming at you on the smooth waves.
We're going to set up our pirate radio station down here, broadcasting to the Tri-County area.
Exactly. We're taking over the world.
That's right.
And actually, the dressing rooms are right there. So this is where when I am at this theater, I hang out quite a lot.
Now, I didn't know you'd been here before. You dropped that when we were talking before, that you'd been here last year.
Yeah, we were here in November. We brought a show called Reeling to the New Vic, and it was really fun. We were on a Southern California tour.
Okay.
And the whole show was set in a dive bar. So the idea was, you know, the dancers were all characters in this crazy dive bar, and it's a night that goes right and wrong in many ways. These are 8 lonely hearts.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Who wrote that?
The work that we do is devised. So I come up with a context or an idea, and then we just develop. I mean, it feels like scenes. It feels like theatrical scenes, but it's told mainly through dance. There's some spoken word.
There's some acting? A lot of acting. All companies have acting. Not all dance companies have acting at all.
No, I actually call what we do dance theater. Ask me what it is I do and what InVertigo does, That's the best way to describe it. It's really hyper kinetic, really athletic dance, but it's blended with a theatricality, with a respect for storytelling, really a drive towards storytelling. And then we often use live music. I really enjoy blending roles. I like it when a musician becomes an actor and then is incorporated into the scene. Sorry, I gesture a lot. I just hit the microphone.
That's okay.
I like blending roles, like smacking microphones apart.
Yeah,
exactly. Well, in the upcoming show that we have, one of our dancers also plays cello. So anytime she's not dancing in a section, she's playing cello with the musicians. So my music director and I actually get into custody battles over her. So
I would imagine she'd be breathing very hard where she sat down to work on the cello.
That is occasionally true.
Get into the cello mode.
Yeah. Amazing. Her name's Hayosan, and she's, I would say a triple threat, but I think she's like a quintuple threat.
Probably.
She's really extraordinary.
There's probably some things she does that she hasn't told you, just in case you make her.
She's also like, she passed the bar exam. She does website coding. It's one of those. She's one of those people that you just step back and you go, when do you sleep?
Wow.
Yeah.
The show is called After It Happened. That's the one that you're bringing to town. The dance company is InVertigo.
Mm-hmm. InVertigo Dance Theater.
Is that the opposite of Vertigo?
I named the company, I actually founded the company 9 years ago and called it InVertigo because invert and vertigo got squished together. And I like the idea of, in the storytelling that I do, of cracking things open, looking at them inside out, turning them upside down, and finding a lot of different perspectives. Mm-hmm. And then also in the morning, if I'm feeling really unmotivated, I just think, invert, I go. And it's just a little easier
to
get
up.
It just gets me up. You know, you start the day with a handstand.
Do you?
Sometimes I would usually just slide out of bed upside down and hope for the best.
Sometimes, maybe if your hands hit the floor first.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you just sort of make sure you cushion the fall. But, you know, I think the name speaks to a lot of things kind of sneakily that I want people to experience with the company, which is you see a certain playfulness. I mean, I like wordplay and I like bringing in a certain whimsical perspective to what we do, and then being able to look at something, even if it's just a word, from a lot of different angles and see something different every time.
Where did you get the idea to combine theater and dance?
It's just always been what I do. Someone was actually asking me earlier today about, you know, who did you dance with before you started your company?
And I
took a really unusual route towards being a choreographer. I started as a choreographer. I've been dancing all my life, but but I have notebooks from when I was 8 years old with just full of choreography, like stick figures, concepts, costumes, bird's eye views, like every song off of Seal's first album and Enya's Sail Away album. They were amazing. It was way more organized than I am now, by the way. And just like speaks to like how cool I was as an 8 year old.
Did you ever share that with friends? Did you ever put on your Orinoco flow?
A little bit. I wasn't, you know, a lot of, you know, actors come out and they're like, yes, we used to put on these shows and I'd make all the neighborhood kids do it. And I didn't really, but I did have, my mom was really, really kind in that I would push all of the furniture back and I would play one song and I would do like one role and like talk her through it. And then I would like play the song again and do like the other role.
Yeah.
And so I think she was probably fairly patient with that. And let me put those, they weren't even shows. They were just really trying to communicate these worlds that were going on in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to just have someone witness that. And so it was very generous of her in a way,
to let me.
And now, you know, now she doesn't have to do that because now I can go into a room full of dancers and be like, okay, here's what's in my brain.
Yeah.
We're going to try and get it out.
Does your mom come to your shows and tell everybody she's
my parents
push the furniture?
She does not reveal the furniture pushing. She's actually, my whole family is really supportive of Invertigo, and it's become in a way kind of almost one of the orbits around which we do things as a family because my mom actually works with our Dancing Through Parkinson's program. So Invertigo has our performance, our professional performing company. We have an education program and we have a Dancing Through Parkinson's program. And my mom goes to most of the classes just to help. One of her best friends has Parkinson's and Linda, and we started the program together. And so she comes to all of these classes. They come, my parents both come to all of the shows. My dad swears he will never dance, and that I did not get it from him, but he's always, really, really supportive of what we do. And my brother actually is my music director.
Well, this is all in the family.
I know. It's like this crazy thing that has just sort of happened. I mean, in some ways we're very close, but we also are really good at boundaries, so.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, that was a skill that everybody developed. But my brother, Toby, is an extraordinary musician. And so he's actually playing and composing for After It Happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's talk about After It Happened, and I want to bop back and talk about all the other things you do. But
yeah,
After It Happened tells the story. I'm trying to sum it up. You can probably correct me.
Sure.
It tells the story of a community where something major happens, like an earthquake or a flood or something like that, and how it's not about the tragedy of the aftermath, although there is some. It's about the human spirit and how even right after something like that, once a little bit of new normal has been established, playfulness and creativity start to pop up.
You should come to one of our rehearsals. I think that, you know, like,
did I get it right?
You could just, yeah, you should, I think you should come, you know, direct a scene.
Okay.
That was great.
Okay.
You're hired.
Yes.
Did you not know that's the way this interview was going to go?
No, I had no idea. Are you going to ask me some other questions later?
Yes.
Okay. Good.
Actually, after you summed it up really, really beautifully, After It Happened is set in the aftermath of an unspecified natural disaster, and that's a deliberate choice because I don't want people to look and say, oh, they're covering Hurricane Katrina or Sandy or the Haitian earthquake. You know, I'm not looking to zoom in on one community in particular. And it's looking at how a community rebuilds, how we process trauma. I mean, we definitely address the transformative powers of trauma, and the darker places that we can go, in these situations. But ultimately looking at how children play, people play, how women still find ways to create beautiful clothing, how, people find ways to support one another and to grieve and to fall in love and to celebrate life. And it's really a testament to our capacity as people to create light and song and hope in any situation.
How did you get inspired by it, and how did you bring it to the company, and like what nascent form did you bring?
The piece came sort of half formed when I was in Barcelona, and I went to a photography exhibit by a photographer named Emilio Marinatti. And it was his work in Haiti about a year after the earthquake had really done a lot of damage. And there was a quality in the photographs that I found so compelling because he did cover a lot of the trauma, but seeing a bunch of grown-ups playing soccer, seeing kids playing with bubbles. There's one photograph of a woman who had cut a hole in one of the blue tarps that you see in a lot of recovery zones, a lot of refugee camps. These blue tarps are kind of omnipresent, and she'd cut a hole in one of them, and it was her profile, and she has this beautiful straw hat, and on her, with this dignity and strength and grace, this tarp looked like an haute couture dress, and she looked so fragile and so strong and so beautiful, and it really made me want to tell this story, to dive into it and to find as many ways to show this transformative state as possible. And it made me want to make people laugh and tell really inappropriate jokes. and it made me want to, strip away those moments where, when affected by PTSD, people can do terrible things to one another. So, that whole range, there was just this complete overwhelming desire to figure it out and put it on stage. And I think it's a subject that's available to all of us in a way. Everyone has suffered in some way loss or has experienced loss, and it might not be from an earthquake. But I'll tell you, in California, we're all really afraid of it all the time.
There's one coming.
Yeah, it's going to happen. So, so it's something that we're all familiar with, whether we're afraid of an impending natural disaster or whether we have experienced loss on a different scale. But it's still a story we understand in another context. And so that was just something that for some reason had to be done. And it's hard to explain that to people when they say, well, why now and why you? And sometimes you say, because it's a story that needs telling.
Were you looking for a subject for a dance? Did you have other things lined up and push those off the table?
When I was in Barcelona, I was actually really burned out. And this was in 2011, so it was 5 years ago. And I was really burned out from a few years. I'd started the company, I guess, 5 years, before that. And there was something about this moment, where I felt really transformed because I was so excited to get home and make this. Mm. So it was a really exciting moment.
I think the travel puts you in a different frame of mind to receive.
Yeah, you're just open
to
it. Yeah. And there's something really magical about that.
So you came back, and so how do you approach this? Like, is this an illustrative version of like how you work with your company? So you came back and told them what?
I came back. I actually did a 15-minute version of the piece for a lovely and wonderful show called Celebrate Dance that happened in Los Angeles every year at the Alex Theater. And it was a wonderful way for me to be able to do a small self-contained piece and just get a part of it out of my head. And the way I work, and the woman, by the way, who I just want to give a shout out is Jamie Nichols, and she's the producer of Celebrate Dance. And, And she in a lot of ways just gave me the space to launch this piece. But the way I developed the piece was to create a short version and then to basically dive in and say, it's too big for 15 minutes. It needs, there's too many stories. And so we created a full evening work for my company, at the Odyssey Theater in Los Angeles in 2014. And, we had a 5-month rehearsal period, which is a long time. Your eyebrows just shot up like 5 months. No, we didn't work. I mean, this wasn't 8-hour days, you know, five days a week. We tend to rehearse, about 12 hours a week. So that, because we pay all of our dancers, which I'm really proud of, but they are all have other gigs and other jobs. And so, so in order to respect that and to give a piece time really to develop, I actually really enjoy the process of having several months to create a show over. And I work really collaboratively. I'm really lucky, and I'm in who the dancers I get to work with, and all of my collaborators, because they're curated out of, you know, all of the people I could be working with. The people that I bring into the room are the ones that I really sense have their own voice as well as their capacity to mold into what else we're doing. So, so the people, the dancers and I get into a room and I'll teach some movement. I'll have them create their own movement and then teach something to someone else. And then I'll shape it into something that fits another vision. And it's really collaborative and it's ever shifting. And it usually comes from a theatrical impulse on my part. So, for example, there's, spoiler alert, there's a section, where there's a funeral, and it's a funeral procession, inspired by, in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, these beautiful, New Orleans funerals that happen. And they're based in spectacle and, or not based in spectacle, but they involve a certain amount of spectacle. They're visually stunning. Music is amazing. And there are these gorgeous processions, but there were tourists coming into this community and getting involved with these funeral processions. And I found this so completely absurd that it seemed only fitting that it, that we magnify that. Yes. So we have a funeral procession. One of our lightest dancers is being carried. Hayo Sun again. So I guess like 6x threat because she's the littlest.
Also on a resume. Yeah. Very light.
Yes. 5 foot does not, you know, can be carried easily. plays dead like a dream. But we have this funeral procession. The musicians are a part of it, and it's really lush. And two of the dancers transform into these tourist characters, taking selfies, getting involved. There's a very big backpack, and it all culminates in one of them kind of being absorbed into this funeral procession, and she becomes a part of it. And the other one is completely oblivious and has this huge backpack that eventually ends up being used as a really fun prop. But that the movement comes within that section came from my having a very specific structure theatrically for how I wanted it to go, and then creating movement based on Egyptian and ancient, I think it was ancient Sumerian, all of these different glyphs around mourning and the rituals we have around mourning. And grief, and so finding ways that could be really structured and yeah.
There's a lot going on.
I know.
What's your notebook like for this show?
It's a nightmare. The notebook tends to have some stick figures, you know, as a holdover from my childhood.
Yeah.
But more than anything, it's looking at the way the piece moves, like overall, what is the arc? Mm. How are you as someone sitting in the audience How are you being moved through this story? Because I really believe that I don't choreograph for the audience. I do believe that you have to remember that when we're on stage, that this is about connection. This is about connecting with the people who are there to witness and to be a part of it. And occasionally I mess with the fourth wall. I'm not going to lie to you, Ted. Like, it happens. some people from the New Vic last year, Jane Reeling, may have ended up on stage. It's hard to say.
Oh, I see.
We don't do that so often, but yeah, I think that it's about looking at how to craft the experience of the viewer. And I think that that's an important component. Mm. So if we stay in one tone, you know, if we stay really sad or really heavy or really energized, you know, how do you vary that? How do you bring people through? And really at the end of any of our shows, I want people to feel as though they have gone so many places and maybe didn't even realize it while it was happening, but it's very immersive.
It can't be too tragic.
Right? Yeah.
It just bum everybody out.
Yeah.
But it makes the comedy sweeter.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes, so
yeah.
The thing I noticed about your company, I don't know how to say this. Let's see if I can say this. They don't look like the usual company, although they
are. Oh, tell me more about that.
Yeah,
I'm intrigued.
Well, when I look at a lot of companies, they seem almost interchangeable. Mm. All due respect, but there's a very particular type. And when I looked at your company, I'm like, they all look very different.
Mm.
Not that the shapes are totally different, but they seem to be very distinct personalities. Just by watching the videos, I already recognized a few of the players.
Yeah.
A few of the dancers.
Yeah, a bunch of hooligans.
A bunch of hooligans. And I thought, yeah, I don't usually get that from other companies. You'd have to be there for some time to see the dancers and go, oh, that's that. You know,
that's the one that did the thing the other time.
Yeah, it would take like 30 minutes for me to start figuring out who's who. But even from the videos that are on your site, I was able to recognize a lot of your dancers. They're very all particular. It was an interesting mix. So I'm curious how you curated your company. Like, what are you looking for?
Mm.
How did you bring people in? And was that a conscious decision?
Well, the fact that everybody looks different just happens because I think that it's great to have a group of people that reflect somewhat the world around us. And so it's not a conscious, you know, we must have people from different races and different backgrounds. But I am, when we hold auditions, I'm really conscientious about reaching out to a lot of different communities so everybody knows that they feel very welcome to come and audition. And then from there, you get a talented, very diverse group of people from whom to draw. And it just sort of shakes out in a way that's really lovely to put on stage and to feel inclusive. I'm in the middle, actually, this is a side note, but I'm in the middle of a delightful little hate mail exchange with someone who was really mad about, in our last audition notice, we said, you know, we're looking for two dancers, one male and one female, comma, or gender non-binary, because I don't know who's going to show up, and I don't, you know, and I want to make sure that people feel that no matter what their gender identity is, that they can come and audition for this little dance company. So it's my own quiet revolution over here, I guess. And I didn't really think anything of it until I got this like really angry email.
From what perspective?
Oh, that we're caving to the political correct. I don't know. No. It's just someone who's mad that some people don't identify as either male or female. That's it.
Okay.
I don't know. But it speaks to, I don't know. I think it speaks to something in Invertigo where we wouldn't have thought twice about that. And we don't think twice about we're always on the side of making sure that voices are at least heard or able to be considered and included. And
you're an LA-based company.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of people in LA from a lot of, you know, there's, There's no reason for a company to look all one way or the other unless that's a very conscious choice. And so my conscious choice is in the other direction. But in terms of, I mean, I do want to come back to your question. That was a little alleyway that we got to go down. As to who is in the room and how they're curated, I mostly have dancers come to me through auditions. One of the dancers, Sophia, has been with me almost since the beginning. So she's been dancing with me for 8 years now. Mm. And she's extraordinary and has really grown with me. I've grown as a choreographer. She's grown as a performer. And she's just one of the most generous performers. When she's on stage, she just brings you there with her. And she's very generous as a collaborator. And they really all are. And I look for people who have the technique, who have the virtuosity, who can come on stage and do insanely wonderful things with their bodies, that really heightens the experience. But I'm never interested in virtuosity for its own sake. I'm interested in virtuosity, or that wow factor from the perspective of, does it captivate me? Does it tell a story? Are you holding space in a way I've never seen someone hold space? And can this bring people in? Can we connect with people through what it is we're doing? So, you can usually tell with someone, if they're going to be a good collaborator or not. And I look for the physical virtuosity. I look for theatricality, and theatrical skills. And people come in with different balances. There's one dancer, Irene, who in After It Happened, that was her first big project with us. And she has a monologue. And she is a beautifully trained dancer. I mean, beautiful. And she's an extraordinary mover. And, she didn't have much of a theatrical, I don't think she had any theatrical experience really, and I pushed her really hard, and now she's just this extraordinary little actress, and you can see she's so into what she does. I mean, she just brings this richness, and she doesn't break character, she reacts, and it's become really lovely to see someone find that. So I think I mostly look for people who are going to say yes and. So it's like with improv, you know, I look for people who, you know, if I come in with a crazy idea, I look for people who aren't going to be like, well, fine. I look for people who go, yes, and what if we added maybe going backwards, doing falling through the air while I say this thing? Or what if we take this lift and turn it into something else and keep going? And that's the exciting thing, because I have a lot of stuff going on in my head, but when it comes to putting it onto bodies, you have to have people in a room who are going to bring this to another level.
I want to ask about your background and where you grew up.
Sure. Because of the funny accent?
It's popping up here and there, certain
know.
Words.
I soften my A's. So I was born in Los Angeles. My whole family's English. I went back and forth between Los Angeles and a few places in England as a kid.
Oh, where are they from?
My mom was born in Edinburgh, but she grew up in Malvern, which is in the middle.
It's in the middle. It's not Scotland.
No.
No.
Okay. My dad was born in London.
Where? Where in London?
I don't know where in London he was born. Which hospital. But I know he spent a lot of time, near, Regent's Park. So Crescent Park.
Nice park.
Very nice park. Some of my fondest memories are of the Mews, right near Regent's Park.
So did you grow up with a California accent and then you just got some from spending time in England? Or
I just tell people I'm really pretentious.
It's like Madonna in her Kabbalah period.
Yes, that is that was my goal, really. Was to be this weird hybrid that annoyed everybody. I started out with an English accent, and then I think I got teased as a kid, and so it sort of softened away. And then anytime I'd go back to England, it'd kind of come back, and it's never been quite American enough or quite English enough to be one or the other. So I sort of settled into this monstrosity.
That's okay. I'm the same way. My parents are British, and I grew up in Santa Barbara. He's from Islington in London. My mom's from
Essex.
I used
to work in Islington.
Islington.
Yeah.
It's changed, though. It's changed.
I know.
Yeah.
It's nice now. Islington's like nice.
Yeah.
It used to be.
Not so nice.
No. Don't tell your dad I said that.
Well, my dad has memories of it's like wartime stuff. So and horses in the streets.
Nice.
My dad's a bit old.
Well, that really wasn't an option when I was working there. But there was a studio there called Moving Art Space.
Oh yeah.
That I got to work at when I was living in London.
So you grew up here. Were you taking holidays back to the UK?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then I also did just over a year in the middle of college. I quote unquote studied abroad, but I wasn't meant to be doing that because I'm technically a UK citizen as well, or a British citizen.
You used to be a European citizen.
Yeah, well, let's talk about Brexit another time. Oh my God.
God damn it.
I know. So motherland, why?
Why? So many places I could have worked for. Where did the dance enter it? Here or in the UK?
I do remember taking classes when I was in London, but when I was, I think, 4 or 5, my mom put me into ballet here. Mm. And I think she just had this ball of energy that needed to be channeled.
Yeah.
And
get her out of the house. I can't keep pushing the furniture around.
True. Little did she know it was going to turn into this. Or she might have been like, piano lessons for you. Mm. But I did, you know, I did piano, I did soccer, I did ballet, and ballet was the thing that stuck, but it was never, it always felt like a means to an end. I really fell in love with contact improvisation and modern dance in high school, and was given my first opportunity to choreograph like for reals in high school. Whoa. And
what high school was that?
Beverly Hills High School.
Beverly Hills High School.
Yeah, I know, the public school version though, so calm down.
Oh, okay.
I think they actually shot the real Beverly Hills High School, like the TV show.
Yeah.
I think they shot it in Santa. Is it true? Did they shoot it in Santa Barbara? Something like that.
I don't think so.
It definitely wasn't. Let me tell you, my high school was not a very photogenic one, but it did have. But I was really lucky in that there was a woman whose passion project as a teacher was this dance company, and her name's Janet Roston. I love that I'm able to give shout outs right now.
Oh,
this
yeah.
is great. I'll like tell them, like, click through to this podcast. You're mentioned. But she was wonderful. She ran this dance company and gave me the opportunity to choreograph, and it was a big deal for me.
How old are you?
I submitted something as a freshman and was told to go away and hone my skills. So sophomore, junior, and senior year, I choreographed 1 and 2 pieces each year. And it was the kind of thing where it was a dream. I mean, it was one of those transformative experiences where you get to do this thing that you really wanted to do for a long time. And when you're a choreographer, unless you're making like solos on yourself, which I don't find myself that interesting, which is why I tell stories. But when you're a choreographer, you need people. You can't lock yourself into a studio and lay down a bunch of tracks. You can't just hole up with the canvas and paint or anything like that. Like this is one of these beautiful, ephemeral, gut deep experiences that happens once on this one body when you're witnessing a dance show. And in order to create that, you need actual people. And so to be given that kind of resource is incredible. And it's why it's one of the reasons I founded my company was to be able to not wait for someone to give me access to that resource through a commission for another company. But to be able to make work with other people who are extraordinary.
So you were aware of the challenges. It sounds like you were aware of the challenges in high school of if you are going to continue to choreograph, you were either going to have this long road, or you're going to have to found a company?
I don't think I ever seriously thought about starting your own company. I think I was 23. That's like an insane life decision. It's kind of like deciding at, you know, like 15, you're going to have a kid. Like, it's just
What were your friends saying? What are they doing? I'm just kind of chilling out after college.
No, I think I got a lot of support from everyone who I told I was doing, you know, that I was doing this. But I don't think any, I think that it came from like, okay, like good luck kind of place. Yeah. But it wasn't intentional. It wasn't my intention. I actually graduated, from college with a dual degree. I had my honors thesis in choreography and production. And then my other thesis was essentially a pre-law degree in queer rights and social movement. So I was going to go to law school. That was my plan.
Oh, I see.
And then I had an amazing conversation with my dad, who said, you know, if you don't know which path you want to go down, be a choreographer first. He's a lawyer, by the way. And he was like, go, you know, you can go back to law school when you're 40 and be a lawyer, but it's going to be much harder as a lawyer to decide you want to be a choreographer when you're 40 or 50. So not to say that it's impossible, and I would actually love to see that happen. I'm sure it has. But I think that's the kind of, parental advice that is rare and such a gift.
That's what I was thinking when you're telling me that story.
It's insane, right?
Like, very few people have that. They either don't get any guidance or they get really bad guidance.
Well, or guidance, I think, that comes from a place of, I don't know if fear is the right word, but a desire. I think as a parent, you know, your desire is for your kid to have some semblance of stability and like, well, what I do is wonderful in many ways. Like, stable isn't one of the adjectives that would readily spring to mind. So in some ways, you know, he just didn't take a particularly conservative approach to it. And I'm eternally grateful for that.
Were you surprised by that?
In hindsight, no, he's, a wise and generous person. But in hindsight also, yes, because I think it is so rare to have that. And I think that maybe it's increasing now. I think we've had like 20 or 30 years of like Hollywood movies of like, follow your dream, it will be fine. And like, you always, you know, and these success stories. So it's getting to a point maybe where that kind of like, go unique individual butterfly, like fly has become something, you know, that people who are parents now have grown up with those movies. So
I would say maybe that's also because they've seen the people who don't follow their dreams and seen what happens and then heard someone say, oh, I always wanted to be this.
Right.
And they never did.
Right.
Sort of thing. So that's, maybe that comes into it. I want to get back to like, when you were caught the choreographic bug, what choreographers were you aware of, and who were you looking at as inspiration?
Now or back as
back then?
Back then, in the mists of time, when there was not YouTube or any of these resources. I was lucky. My parents would take me to see shows. We did go to quite a number of Nutcrackers, I think. I hate that show now.
You've never been in a Nutcracker?
I don't think I've ever been in the Nutcracker. I've certainly seen my share.
Yeah.
And now I've developed a fondness for it, but I do remember as a child, both my brother and I like rebelled. We were like, not again. But so I was aware of ballet. And then we would go and see, I mean, I had two working parents, but like my mom still managed to like take us to see a lot of random things. We would go to the theater. We would go to, strange performance art and we would go. And once she became really aware that dance was a passion of mine, we would go and see whatever was happening at Highways Performance Space or other venues, and anything that was going on at the music center, we would go and sit like way up in the
gods.
We would stare down like the lofty beings we were. And so I don't remember a specific choreographer that I looked at and said, I want to be that person, but I do remember watching things happening on stage and thinking, I want access to that.
Yeah.
Or I can see what I would do. It wasn't even like a jealousy thing. I didn't say I want that. I would look at it and think, oh, I would do this. And what if that happened? And it was really exciting. And we went to quite a bit of Shakespeare plays. So because my parents both love Shakespeare and both love the theater. And so I remember seeing a production of The Tempest in London, and
where at?
I was little, so I don't remember. It may have been the Barbican. I might have been the Globe. And I remember the actor playing Ariel had this movement quality that was so otherworldly and so ethereal, and I remember being really impressed by that. And then I remember the actor playing Caliban had this other completely different way of moving his body. So it remains one of my favorite Shakespearean plays.
I wonder what production that was.
I know. I'm kind of one thing that's crazy is if I dig through, I am not a hoarder. I'm really not. God, I can't believe I just opened it. Let me rephrase.
That was kind of defensive there. No,
I get rid of a lot of things. I'm not into having a lot of possessions, but one thing I keep like a psychopath is, the programs from like many of the things almost all of the things I've ever seen, I keep programs, and I've sort of had to stop that in the last like 10 years because as like a professional person, you know, in the dance scene, I go and see a lot.
Yeah.
So it got to a point where I was like, there's too many boxes. So I've gotten a little more selective, but I keep programs, and I actually wonder if there's a program floating around. If it started as early as like 7 or 8, the warning signs were there.
Jump ahead to wanting to form your own company. How do you form your own company?
That's such a good question.
How do you do it? So maybe there's someone listening who has that urge. What's the first step? How do you do it?
The first step is an abstract one, and it's vision, and it's what eventually becomes your mission statement. So the first step is the why, and this drive. And so for me, I was in Los Angeles. I'd come back from London supposedly for 3 months, and it had been a year. It's like the Hotel California. You can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. Yeah. And I was planning to move back to London, but I kept getting work. I kept getting commissions or jobs and things to do as a choreographer. And when you're in our line of business, you go or you stay where the work is. And you don't go, well, I have a hypothetical career that's just starting out in an entirely other place. So I was back from London and I looked around, and it felt like very few people were paying dancers in Los Angeles. And I believe passionately in that. It didn't seem like the style of dance theater that I really love was happening in LA. So I wanted to make that kind of work happen, and I wanted to continue to create communities. I wanted the brand of dance that I really love to create and to share balances an accessibility with the compelling, thought-provoking richness that if you have one without the other, you know, if something's so accessible, it's just like cotton candy. But if something's so deep and thoughtful and compelling, then it can veer into the esoteric and can be, potentially alienating or it can not be something that reaches out and invites the audience in. So I wanted to make that style of work. So that was the why, and that was this abstract first step. And then the first real step is I named it. And I made it up. I mean, I named it. I pretended it was real, and people kind of played along, and I did a lot of the groundwork, you know, in terms of forming a 501c3 and doing all of the paperwork and balancing, you know, and I say my title is the artistic director. The artistic part can be a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And then there's the director part. There's the part where you have to make sure that the business of this company is on point. Mm-hmm. And so we have an executive director now who I love. Hello, Tara. Thank you for being in our world. But, you know, in the first few years of having a company, you're the mother, father, and Holy Ghost of the damn thing, and mm-hmm. you keep it alive in any way you can. Mm-hmm. And it begins with, you know, your friends and family maybe believing and donating to what now would be like a Kickstarter campaign, or going out and finding people to sponsor you because you can put together a decent sponsorship package. And you just pretend it's real, and you ask a lot of people a lot of questions, and you take a lot of notes, and you do as much as you can, and eventually it becomes real. So you kind of conjure it out of thin air. But I really believe that this is true, and I realize that I am, you know, extraordinarily lucky to have a supportive family, to, you know, in terms of people, you sort of feeling like people have your back, in a way. But I think that that's how companies get started, is with someone having a vision and other people playing along. And then eventually it's been around long enough and has done enough paperwork that it's kind of real.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I started it.
What was your first rehearsal location? And what was your first performance?
Our first performance was at Highways Performance Space, which was also where I'd seen like my first contemporary dance. It was Victoria Marx, was the first contemporary dance show I think I ever saw. And Highways was willing to co-produce. So they, which is great because it meant that it took a little bit of the risk, away from doing the first show. And our first rehearsal was, I think, at the Diavolo space downtown Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah.
And I trained with Diavolo for I think a month the year before, and they let me have a little bit of the rehearsal space for free, and then I did some trade, and then I raised some money, and you know, and the dancers were all people that I'd kind of seen around, you know, in the year that I'd been back, and kind of edged up and, you know, asked them. It was like asking someone to go to prom. It was like, well, if you want to maybe do this thing, like, we can pay you a little bit, but like, you don't have to, but it'd be really cool, but like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although I said that the other day, and someone was like, yeah, that's not how kids ask each other to prom now. It has to be like, there's like a flash mob or something.
Oh, really? That's how?
Yeah. It's kids, like a, it's a production.
Days. Yeah. Did the first person you asked to prom then accept?
Yeah. The amazing thing about high school prom or like dancing? Okay.
No, just continue your metaphor. Did you get a corsage?
I love the idea of, like, you know, maybe handing someone like a corsage and being like, congratulations, you're in Vertigo. You wear this forever now.
Yeah.
Oh.
Pin it to their chest.
Yes.
That's nice.
Like accidentally, like, draw blood.
Yes.
Accidentally drawing blood occasionally happens in a rehearsal. You know, blood, sweat, and tears.
Yeah. Well, it's dance.
We did have a dancer once where we were like, it's just not rehearsal. Carol's not bleeding somehow. That's the thing about being a dancer. Answer, though, you know, you'll tear your foot open and keep going. I have a ridiculous bruise on my foot from a site-specific piece we're doing where I just like put my foot directly on a screw that was coming out of the ground.
Ooh.
And you know, you tape it up and you finish the rehearsal.
Ow.
I know, dancers are crazy.
Did it pierce the flesh?
It did a little. Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Did you have to get shots?
I didn't, although I probably should have looked.
Maybe you should have.
No, I have a tetanus. I'm very up to date on my tetanus.
Okay, good. It's a great story of asking these people, and it doesn't seem like you got a lot of rejection.
I've had plenty of rejection. I mean, the first person I asked said yes, but a lot of other people, you know, either couldn't commit or I wasn't paying enough because in the beginning, you know, I still don't think we pay enough, but we definitely pay on par with, we definitely pay a reasonable amount at this point. which I'm really proud of.
I want to talk about that.
Yeah. Okay.
That's super awesome.
And, but in the beginning, you know, you're paying what you can. But I think that dancers especially, really just, they want to perform. They want to make work. People want to get involved with an artist that they think is going to give them the opportunities to really come alive on stage and to create something that they're proud of, which is, by the way, a reason I think a lot of people can get away without paying dancers. And I'm sure as this extends, of course, to actors, musicians, and, you know, all the other performing arts. So that's one of the reasons I didn't get as many no's in the beginning when I couldn't pay very much. But I think that part of doing what we do as artists is experiencing rejection all the time.
Yes.
And keeping a good perspective on that. And that's just a part of it. And I had to learn from both sides. I've learned from getting rejected, like from grants. Oh my God, all the time.
Yeah.
And the ones that you do get, you're just like, really? are you sure?
But take this money back.
I know. No. Yeah. I wouldn't go that far. Like, just deposit the check before they figure it out.
Yeah, actually do that.
Fill out the paperwork quickly. No, but, you know, experiencing a lot of rejection from festivals, from presenters. I mean, that's the nature of the game, is that you're going to experience a lot of rejection. But then I also run auditions. And, you know, a couple years ago, I had over 100 people show up for 2 spots.
Oh, gosh.
And yes. I have to say no a lot. And, you know, I have a very particular philosophy around auditions, which is to make them about connecting, community building, getting to know people. I really try and maintain a very respectful atmosphere to, you know, to honor the fact that people are bringing time and talent and energy into the room. So instead of being like, number 5, you can go. Thanks. but it does mean that I learn a lot in terms of how people behave towards me once they've been, you know, essentially rejected. And, you know, if you want to look at it from that perspective, I'm always really impressed with the dancers who maintain grace, maintain contact, who come and see shows, who come to classes. I've hired people who have auditioned for me once or twice already because I know them now, because they've come back, because they've come to a lot of classes, they've asked for feedback. And that actually, I learned a lot in terms of grants or in terms of other presenters, you know, in places where I experience so much rejection, to remember what it's like to be on the other side in both situations.
You seem to be on a very even keel. Maybe just for this interview.
But I'm just really drunk right now.
He is bringing a case.
Mom,
of,
I'm kidding.
A case of wine down the stairs
both,
at some point.
Tara and Mom, if you're listening, that was a total joke.
No, we're completely sober. It's too early.
Totally. Sure. Is it though?
Is it really? no. Well, but
pre-gamed this interview real hard.
I'm curious where you learn that. It seems like you have a very, as I say, an even keel. And do things roll off you quite easily?
Sometimes. And, you know, the things that are really difficult to deal with, I'm lucky I have a husband who's really good at kind of just nodding, and listening and letting and making a space. I think that there are always going to be things that are extraordinarily painful when you're running a company and when you're making art and when you're just being a human, there are going to be things that are really painful or really difficult. But, I think that there's just ways to make space for that and then to move forward. So, you know, from my dad, I get the, like, let's look at this from every angle side. And then from my mother, I get the very English, like, pick yourself up and take your next steps forward. And I think that that's something that I've learned a lot, that you don't rage in public. You do it in private.
You do it in private.
No, but I think that it's all balanced out by the fact that I feel so lucky to be able to do what I do, that even when, you know, things are deeply painful or really difficult, at the end of the day, you just have to feel so lucky for whatever it is you do have. And so I think that that practice of gratitude is very helpful. You know, and the day drinking, obviously.
The day drinking helps that too. Yeah. You've made a brief foray, or your company has, into film. Are you going to do more of that? And what do you like about that process?
So are you talking about the mine
yes,
film?
Yes, the one that was done in the mine.
Right. So I dragged two of my beautiful dancers out to the desert, and we camped overnight. And then I got everybody up way before daylight, and we started shooting at dawn. And it's this big abandoned mine and this building that we found. And it was one of the only buildings that we literally could have gone into. It was wildly dangerous and very illegal to be there. But I loved being in a space where there was just poetry in the landscape, where I could be in a space that was so evocative that I didn't need to build a set, that there was something about this space that seemed to bring out a totally different, quality to the dancers. And so that was something I really loved about film, was being able to bring the audience, to a space that otherwise wouldn't really be. You know, I'm not really going to put a busload of people, you know, and take them out to the Mojave and be like, come into this wildly dangerous area. don't touch anything. You might get tetanus.
That's right.
And so I liked that. And I liked being able to see the movement from a lot of different angles. The duet that we created is called Mine. And it's really about this shared strength between two people. I can tell you the dancers probably had a very different experience from me, because we started shooting at 5:30 in the morning with dawn, and we kept shooting until just past noon. Have you seen the whole film, or have you seen the?
No, just seen the extras.
Oh, I'll send it to you. Okay. I think you'll really like it.
Yeah, can we see the whole thing?
You cannot see the whole thing yet. It actually premiered. Yeah. You can see the trailer on our Vimeo page, but then at some point we'll release the whole film, but right now we're submitting it to a lot of film festivals. Its grand world premiere was at UCLA's Royce Hall a month ago, which was really exciting, and it was part of Dance Camera West, which is a really big, beautiful dance film festival here in over in Los Angeles. And that was a yes that felt great, because that was a no. I'd been rejected from that film festival like several times before.
Oh.
So it finally happened, and was really exciting. And I think that something about dance film that's so wonderful is that as the person with the camera, you are intimately involved with the choreography of the dance, that you are, that the camera is part of, needs to be choreographed just as much as the bodies. And that was really fascinating to me. And I think that on the flip side, I also choreograph. This was told to me a few years ago. It made a really big impression. A cinematographer actually said, you choreograph like a cinematographer, which I thought was really weird and interesting. And what he meant was, you know, what we do often as choreographers is we draw the eye to different parts of the stage in different ways. And I do this more than even some other people, I think, because I have a lot going on stage at any given time in a lot of these shows. So, for example, after it happened, you know, this community, it's not like everybody just disappears off while one thing is happening. There's always something going on in the background. It's like those Dutch paintings where you have like a million things happening in the background, and then, you know, the one main scene. And my job is to draw your eye where I want it, but to give you the option as a viewer, if, you know, you might catch something out of the corner of your eye that then informs how you relate to this person later. And that's, that's something that I think was really interested in actually jumping over and making a dance film. In some ways, I was kind of like, oh, well, people are going to have fewer choices now because they have to look at exactly what I'm telling them to look at. Hmm. I loved that power. Yeah.
What number film was that?
That was our third dance film. The first one was also in the Mojave, just because there's so much space out there.
Yeah.
And people don't tend to come and check on you. And you
check your permits.
We did get permits for the first one, but I was like, never again. That was $900 nonsense. although if anyone's listening to this, of course I would get permits. Permits for everything.
Oh, yeah.
but we shot there, and then we shot a film called Tumbleweeds on a Hillside. And then we shot mine. Wow. So yeah, the other two were definitely learning experiences. And this last one, I felt a little bit more like I had a handle on how to shoot the duet so that I would as an editor, cause I do the editing as well. So I felt like I understood how to shoot it because I'd been through that process a few times.
The last thing I want to mention or ask you about is your dance through Parkinson's. Is it a workshop? Is it a weekly class? What is it?
It's a program. It's an engagement program, and we have 4 weekly classes now and 2 monthly classes. And so it's in 6 locations all over Los Angeles. Because, you know, when you have Parkinson's, just getting around Los Angeles in any situation is psychotic. And if you have Parkinson's or any kind of issue with mobility, location becomes a really big deal. So, you know, accessibility being one of our main goals, at the top of the year, I was like, no more new locations. We went from 2 to 5 last year, like no more. And then somehow now we have 6. like they're like rabbits. But I started the program along with Sophia, my dancer, and Linda, who is sort of another mother to me. And she was a dancer for all of her life. And when she was diagnosed with Parkinson's, she was finding some of the classes she was going to, even the easy ones, were getting really hard. And we were just talking one day, and I was like, well, you know, what do you want to do? Do you want to do yoga together? Do you want to dance together? Do you want to start a dance class together? Let's start a dance class together. and so we really just thought about ways to structure the class. We trained with a group called the Mark Morris Dance Group in Brooklyn. So Dance for PD, they have a program called Dance for PD that they started with the Brooklyn Parkinson's Group. And it was a good way for us to wrap our minds around like what this program is. I think our classes look quite different from theirs, but it was great to have a structure, and it was great. They're like a big sibling. You kind of look up to them and go, oh, it's possible. Mm-hmm. I will. And the classes themselves are so joyful. We also had a partner, named Andrea Hodes, who, runs Moving Body Pilates. And she came in and was a wonderful way, or a wonderful person to partner with for these classes. These classes are joy. They're about moving together. They're legit dance classes. They're no joke. And we're really careful not to be kind of condescending, like, come on in, everyone. You're doing great. they're wonderful and really creative, wide range of music. We play amazing music. We take a lot of requests. We had one person request, you know, usually we're playing, you know, like Ella Fitzgerald and the Beatles and, you know, and a wide range of music. My personal favorite, I bring James Brown to like every class that I teach. all the teachers have different styles. And they're all quite eclectic. And then we had like one of the participants was like, well, my granddaughter is really into Lady Gaga right now, so maybe we could do something to that. And I was like, okay.
Sure.
So we did a cross the floor to Bad Romance. But they're phenomenal classes. We start seated. Everyone starts in a circle seated, and we do, as any progression for any dance class, you warm up. We often do a port-a-bras, which is just fancy French for move your arms beautifully. We'll do brain teasers or something to get people creating new pathways for movement. We find that dance really helps people to because it's so unfamiliar, you're creating new neuropathways, new connections within your body. We do seated choreography, so we teach them a whole piece of choreography, but it's seated, so balance isn't as much of an issue, so people can move really big. Mm. You know, they can like stretch big, they can reach if they're reaching for something, they can really go for it. And then those who can and choose to will stand, we always have an equally fun and engaging seated option, because we don't want people to feel like there's a better or worse. I'm really big on the horizontal spectrum of movement, as opposed to vertical better and worse spectrum. And then, so we'll use the back of the chair as a modified ballet bar. And then the chairs will be moved aside and we'll go across the floor. We'll do center combination standing. Sometimes we do improvisation or community choreography. Every class is different. And one thing we always do is we do end in a circle, as a way of just sealing in, the fact that we all just did it.
Yeah.
And
do you see progress?
Yeah. It's, and especially we started these classes 5 years ago. We celebrated our fifth anniversary. We had the party in June, but we actually had been doing it, for 5 years, starting in February, I think. And some people have been doing this for 5 years, and I realized, like, oh my God, we have had to make these classes harder.
I see.
Which is great. We are very careful to tell people that we're not, this is not therapy. Mm-hmm. This is not physical therapy. We're not making medical claims. But anecdotally, we see people standing taller. We see people standing with broader shoulders. We see balance improving. A lot of them come in and say, oh my gosh, my neurologist wanted to know what I'd been doing because I'm doing so much better on these tests, and that's always really gratifying. But the biggest thing that I see that makes me the happiest is to see people gaining confidence, and feeling less isolated. The fact that they come in and they realize that this is their community, that this is a place that they are celebrated. They're not just there to exercise and to improve, but they are truly celebrated for being there. And that, I think, is such a rare and wonderful thing. And it's something I value so much about this program.
What's your routine in the morning? What's your daily routine?
Other than turning upside down.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like you do so much. How do you balance it?
How do I balance? I don't. I this year, my New Year's resolution was to take a weekend once in a while. It's going.
Has it happened yet?
Poorly. No, I, my morning routine is, I get up, I walk our dog Pacha. I'm unrelenting about breakfast because otherwise I'm a mess. And then it's just true. Unrelenting about it. I don't compromise. And
what does that mean? It has to be like what, bacon and eggs?
Oh no, gross. I won't skip breakfast. I used to, but I can't skip it. And so it's usually like, I don't know, oatmeal and fruit or eggs and toast, but
not as unrelenting as
I
bacon.
Yeah, no. Although I do like the idea of like unrelenting bacon, like you're just crying and eating bacon. I don't want it anymore. or I make really disgusting looking smoothies. They're like green. It's just gross looking. You know, like lean into it. I will own the fact that my smoothies look gross.
Yeah.
and then my office is, the Invertigo office is in the garage of my home. And so we've converted. It's so beautiful. It's the nicest room in the house, by like a lot. And, so I'm in the office generally, fairly early. And, I don't really have a routine because every day, you know, I might be in Santa Barbara. I'm doing a podcast. It's hard to know. But I spend quite a bit of time in my office, quite a bit of time in the dance studio when we are in rehearsal. And then, a large part of my job as an artistic director is meetings, is creating connections with people. And that's a lovely, it's a lovely thing to be able to do. You just need to make sure it doesn't like overwhelm your whole time so that you can still do stuff like the graphic design for the flyer that needed to be at the printers 4 days ago.
Are you doing the graphic design too?
I do. Oh. Not all of it. We actually have now we had a graphic design intern last summer, and now she's a freelance employee for us. And we love her. She's so much better at it than I am. But no, I mean, really, yeah. Because I started this company in the beginning, I did the graphic design. I did the publicity. You know, I did all of the PR. I, you know, kept the books. I did all of those things. And then gradually over time, I let different things go. But I don't know why. I never seem to have like less to do. I think it's the fact that the capacity of the company has grown. And so anytime I get something off my plate, like five more things show up. Yeah. But I'm really lucky in that I get to create, I get to teach. I love teaching our Dancing Through Parkinson's program when I can. And I teach a lot of the master classes that we do. And working with professionals is always really a joy. And we have our whole education. I very rarely teach for our education program, because we have people who are way better at it than I am. The director of the program, Sadie, is also one of our dancers, and she's extraordinary. She can teach anybody. And so, yeah, my days are really varied. At some point on any given day, I really try and spend some time in my garden. My husband and I grow a lot of our food. Which is nice.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, we have a little patch, and it's not a very big area, but it is big enough to grow quite a lot of the produce that we eat.
Nice. And you're gonna get chickens?
That's the next step, yeah. I really want them, but we don't have quite enough space for it.
Okay.
And, all right. But I spend a lot of time asking for fluffy animals, and my husband spends a lot of time saying no. So I'll come up with like, okay. I want a bunny. I want four cats. I want an alpaca. I want a teacup elephant. I really, by the way, if anybody out there makes teacup elephants, please get in touch with me. I want one so much.
You heard of that.
I don't know if they make them.
I don't really know what a teacup elephant is.
You know, they're like teacup. They have like teacup pigs, like the small pigs. Like, I just want a small elephant.
That never grows.
Well, you know, like maybe hip height, you know, I still want him to be, I don't want him to be like chihuahua size. I want him to be like, you know, like hip height or like maybe chest height.
Nothing you can carry around in a purse, but something you could like.
No, I don't want anything I can carry around in a purse. I'm not a big fan of like very small dogs.
Okay.
I mean, I'm fine with other people want to have them. I just don't want one.
Yeah. Okay. Something, but you could walk around the neighborhood.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I would take him for a walk with my dog and we would parade around.
Everyone loves a parade.
I know.
Especially with elephants.
You know, unless it's a funeral procession that you're disrupting in a wildly inappropriate way.
And taking photos of.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Selfies. Hashtags.
Now, the show is after it happened. It's coming here when?
October 22nd at 7 p.m. and October 23rd at 2 p.m. And we're at the New Vic Theater, which is on Victoria, just near State Street.
That's right.
Yes. And come see the show. Like, you should come see the show.
Because I'm going to come see the show.
It's just going to be such a delicious, rich world to step into. There's so much going on in it. I'm not even trying to sell it. Like, I really just want you to be there.
Oh, it sounds awesome.
Yeah.
It sounds really good.
Thanks.
All right. Okay, well, Laura, thank you so much.
Thank you for letting me talk way too much.
No, that's what it's about. That's
I
what
really
the interview
enjoyed
is
it.
For. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Ted.
Thanks so much. Cheers.
Cheers.
There you have it, folks. Laura Carlin in conversation. That show, again, is coming here October 22nd and 23rd of this year at the New Vic. It's called After It Happened. And the company is called Invertigo Dance Theater. You can find them at www.invertigodance.org. Go check it out. Get some tickets. Why don't you? And come check it out. And if you see me there, say hello. Why don't you? For me, as you know, you can go to funkzonepodcast.com and subscribe. You can go to Twitter at Ted Mills at Twitter and follow me there for my ramblings, and like us on Facebook at the Funk Zone Podcast. And why not subscribe to us on iTunes and leave us a nice review as well? That would be nice, and that would be good
for my ego. Ooh. Okay. All right. That is it for me this week. Thank you. We'll be back next week with another show and more information on that 100th episode coming up. So exciting. Okay. I'm going to leave the last word to my friend Joseph from second grade back in the day so many years ago. Tell him what's up, Joe. I'll see you later, folks. Bye.
And now for a big goodbye. See you soon. We'll make some more tapes later on. Bye. We might make some more tapes later on. Bye. We might make more tapes later on. Yeah. See you soon. Bye.